which is reflecting the stochasticity. And the crucial part for the stochasticity is that this has a square root of rho in it times eta. Okay, so this is just white noise. Okay. And this square root of rho is crucial for this kind of noise, because that reflects this process here. If I look at what n will go to at another time, right? N will go, if I look at this instead of the averaging, this will the n of t plus one, n of t will grow as n of zero e to the st, but there'll be plus or minus order square root of n naught times there in short time. And so I have this fluctuation part there, so the fluctuation has to have the square root of rho. Okay. And this correctly accounts for all of the fact that you really have discrete individuals rather than continuous ones, but I can treat rho as being continuous. Okay. And then I've got a part which is a spatial a migration. So I've got a part here which is plus the integral, say, of, this is of x, the integral over y of j of x minus y, under of y, and then just so I don't have to keep it in there twice, I'll just subtract all rho and j, so that this doesn't change the overall population. So then the important thing is what is this? What is this kernel here? It's related to directed percolation with long-range things, and so actually there's some recent work that I should mention by Chatterjee and. Day, which actually looks at this model in the context of directed population. Okay. Then you sort of don't really have the dynamics in a simple way. This one, the dynamics is much more is there from the beginning. And in fact, thinking about it in terms of dynamics is going to be easier, and you can actually get better results.
Just to make sure I can continue to follow, x is indicating distance in sequence space, and y.
No, it's spatial. This is real space. Right? This is real space. Sorry?
When you talk about
this is space. This is now spatial space. I'm jumping from one position to another.
Okay. So the first two terms are Fisher equation.
Right.
And noise, and then.
And this is the fluctuations. Okay. So this is stochastic one. Fisher equation has a Laplacian. Right. So the one thing I would normally do, I would replace this by d.
Exactly, I see.
Okay. And then you get a familiar equation, which is some other Fisher or KPP, or I'm sure they have lots of other names, depending on the nationality.
And that Laplacian, is it a limit of your kernel?
Yes. So the Laplacian is the limit when this is short range. Okay, and I'll say when this is a good approximation.
Do you assume Gaussian polynomial?
Sorry?
Gaussian
polynomial.
And rho f is the last one is
the last term is just to make it so that the integral of this is zero.
Okay.
Right. So it's not. So most of these things will turn out not to be crucial once I get to the interesting cases, but they're crucial for understanding simple cases which are already a lot is known about.
And so in the Fisher equation, the front width is set but that d essentially.
Right. So the Fisher equation there's a characteristic length.
But, I see, and in this case, there isn't.
There is, depending on the range and so on. There is a characteristic length. Okay. In some cases not, and so on. Okay, so that's the things we want to understand. So there is a model which is known in the literature. It's not connected with this. It's the dynamics under which people would simulate such things, which is known as the Wright Fisher model. And I'm looking for a collaborator of the name R-O-N-G who uses it as a last name. As many people for this is a first name. So actually in different contexts, because I would really like to have a paper that was called that. And you'll notice that there's a sort of symmetry in the misspelling of where the W goes. So it's doubly wrong. But it turns out there actually is a scientist whose last name is W-O-R-N-G, and who actually, interestingly enough, works in Africa and may even be interested in epidemics, I don't know. So this is the basic model that we want to understand. And the behavior of this I can understand pretty simply in several limits. Okay. So if I look at the very simple limit where everything just mixes with everything else. Okay, so if I look at in that context we call well mixed, or infinite range, where J is independent constant, which of course depends on whatever one of them is. Well, the system, so it can jump from anywhere to anything else, then of course I don't need a spatial structure at all. And then what do we know? Well, N, which is just integral over all row over all space. This then just grows grows exponentially, so N will just grow as e to the s times t. But I'm going to be a little careful here. There's a time at which it appears to have started. Okay, so if it started at time zero, it would just be this. There's a time at which it appears to have started, and it will grow like this until my n is of order rho hat times the total volume. Okay. So the I can, this is the say that I can name this be n hat, the maximum total total number. So how long does that take? Well, if it's just e to the st, the time it takes, so the time for it to take over the whole population or spread everywhere, then grows basic time scale of 1 over s, and just times logarithm of this total total size. So the maximum. So this is where it's just entirely deterministic. Now what happens,
spatially,
there's no spatial now, right? This is infinite range. No spatial.
Sorry? You do that from the negative term here?
Yeah, the negative doesn't matter too much, but it's not, it just, it's, I want to, this is just moving, it around, so I want to move things up with conserving the number. But that doesn't matter.
So J is an actual infected person carrying it from X to Y?
So it's an infected person carrying it from X to Y, or a mosquito carrying it, or things being carried in the wind, and so on. And then in general, so there's a, you know, an interesting, why does one expect long-range things? Obviously with humans, we go around long distances. But even if your things with humans aren't involved at all, convective mixing, advective mixing, whatever the right word is, of things getting carried around, that tends to have parallel tails, as several people in the group have worked on. And so if you just ask if you have a process which has parallel tails in it, normally you say they don't matter much as long as it's diffusive, as long as the mean square distance you move is finite, but in this case it does matter even then. But actually the mixing, it can be long enough range from vector mixing that in fact there is a much longer tail than that, especially if you have prevailing winds and so on. So in fact there's an issue about spreading around the Earth and sort of biology more generally. It is probably true that a lot of the limiting factors associated with how long evolutionary processes take is associated with spatial spread. If you look at from the point of view of a bacterium, you know, a good mutation is one that conveys drug resistance. Right? Or if you're flu, a good mutation is the one that enables you to beat the immune system from what's there before. Right? So those are good mutations and you spread around. And that spread, even I say without humans involved in the transport, a lot of the limiting factors are probably associated with spatial spread. But that's a subject which has not been addressed all that much beyond the short-range models. And so that's relevant here. That was sort of the motivation for it. We weren't interested in epidemics from the beginning, but then, you know, obviously things are connected to epidemics. So this is the deterministic approximation. Okay. But if I now put a ask about the stochasticity, what does the stochasticity do? Right. So if it's now stochastic, well, the stochasticity do basically makes tor, which is that when it appeared to start. Actually, let me not call it tor because I want tor for something else. When it appeared to initiate, that this quantity here, which is when it appeared to initiate, if I extrapolate backwards, right? So I measure my n as a function of time, so I can look at log n, the total of the function of time. So at late times, it's growing exponentially, so this is exponential. But then early times, when the numbers are getting down to one, the fluctuations played a role. Okay, and I can ask if it actually looked like that. I can ask what happens if I extrapolate backwards and ask when I got down to one. So that would be my apparent time when it initiated. So it turns out this quantity is random, and it's a nicely behaved distribution, and there's a pretty simple intuition for it about it, that all that matters is the first few generations, actually the first of order 1 over s generations, where you get a lot of stochasticity. After that, the numbers are big enough that the square root factors don't matter, and it just grows exponentially. So all the stochasticity comes from early times at the initial stages. Okay? And then after that, it's pretty deterministic. Okay? So the deterministic is a good approximation up to small variations in when it started. Now, it turns out the right extrapolation is not back to 1, it's back to something else, but I don't want to
When you say the deterministic, what controls the rate, the effective rate at long times?
It's exponentially growing, right? This is, I've got an exponential growth. Right, so the whole population is growing exponentially except for the saturation. Sorry?
It's just normal, it's just the S
that
started,
right.
Or is it changed a little bit?
No, see, yes. I mean, it can change, of course, saturating and so on. So there's all kinds of complications you can put in, right? But this is the simplest way. So this is well understood, except not as well understood by people who write lots of papers on it as it should be, because this stochastic process is rather important to understand well, and people tend not to somehow, they do stupid things. Anyway, okay.
You will not be interested in the
critical region
of S is
small. Yes, this is S is small, right? So the time scale is set by S. So I am interested in when S is small. But there's an initial stage, which is like this, right? Even if I have long distance spread, initially I'll get exponential growth until it starts saturating locally, and then the spreading matters.
So
no, I'm not interested. I get the scaling with S is turned out to be simple. Okay, so I can, and there's length scales and so on that come in, which I'll say in a second. So that's the infinite range case. Okay, so the other case, which is well studied, when it's short range. Okay, now exactly the conditions for short range we have to come to is what it is, but I can certainly approximate it by this in that case. So in that case, if it's short range, I can make the deterministic approximation again, and I can ignore this. Okay, now for here, the deterministic approximation worked very well. It just gave me a little bit of fluctuations initially. Here, the deterministic approximation is not as good as that, but it's still very good. If I look at the deterministic approximation, and I can, just to see how things work, I can stick an epsilon in front of this term, and then we're going to want to ask how things depend on epsilon. Okay. And I can rescale things. Epsilon really depends on rho hat or rho and v and so on. Okay, but just, I want to ask how it depends on the sort of fluctuation parameter. Okay, so the deterministic then is epsilon goes to zero, and then the spread is very simple. If I'm looking in space, it starts out here, I get some local thing, it grows exponentially until it gets to a point where it starts to saturate, and then starts to saturate and then starts to grow. And basically, you end up after a short amount of time with getting a moving front, and so you have a front here that moves, and it moves at speed v, and in higher dimensions it just goes out as a circle or a sphere, and then it's saturated here, and I want to just ask what the speed is. Okay, and that's one where there's an enormous number of papers on it, but there's a two-line argument that I won't give, which is that v goes as 2 times the square root of d times s.
What about the width?
That I'm saying. So this goes to the square root of ds. This is the only you think of units of speed in the problem when I throw that away, or I can just rescale things out. It has to go as this, and all the difficulty is getting into 2. Okay, but I said there's one line argument that is correct.
And the d is the d.
Yeah, this is the d.
So it's not true.
So this is the fusion kernel. Right.
And you're going to explain to us how, for the general kernel, you can maybe get a renormalized d or something.
For people who like renormalized quantities, I might explain that. I will.
If it's renormalized, where do you care about the 2? I don't understand.
Because this is a quantity you can measure. The D is a quantity you can measure, in principle. Yeah. I don't care much about the 2 people. Other people care a lot about the 2. Okay. So this is the result here, and there's a characteristic length scale. So the width of this, right, there's some scale there, which clearly the only thing it can be is square root of D over S. That's the character. Which means I can say immediately how long a time I get in this regime. Okay, so this is being enormously beaten to death, this problem. If you put in fluctuations, okay, so small epsilon, it gets actually rather challenging, and there's heuristic arguments that get it very quickly, and I think this is really certainly the first real understanding of it due to Bernard Derrida, but there's probably other people who did relevant things before that. So the behavior of small epsilon is rather subtle, so if I call this V naught, this is in the limit of epsilon equals 0, that the V for small epsilon goes as V naught into 1 minus order 1 over log squared of epsilon. Okay. So there's very weak corrections for small epsilon. There's a little bit here. It doesn't go to zero rapidly with epsilon, okay, but it's some correction. And you can ask what happens as the noise starts getting to be order one. And it changes things by coefficients of order one. Okay, so as Shankar's thing, I don't really care about the coefficient there. I don't know what the parameters are anyway. All the equations in biology are wrong, right? And so I shouldn't care too much about it. But there are very interesting phenomena that go on near this front. Okay, and those phenomena are particularly interesting if you start asking, like, who did you get infections from and things like that. Right? So as soon as you start tracing things, which you can trace through genetics, by the sequencing DNA and so on, there are all kinds of interesting things associated with this process which are important or can, you know, at least can be important.
Do you have an experimental case of that?
This is a good question. Albert, is there an experimental case of this?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
There are some which people will say have spread of certain populations in the wild, but then, you know, they're all very loose, and I don't know of a good case. Probably, if there are cases, one would look in more physics contexts, right? Because this is going into an unstable medium. This is the front going into an unstable medium. So things that can happen at phase transitions and so on are better examples. The stochastic effects there are usually very small. And so if I wanted a good example to actually test quantitative things, why don't you do that?
So I think Howard Burke has some in Petri dishes, right, where they see these fronts moving.
Yeah, oh no, you can certainly see a front, you can certainly see a front moving, but the level of getting quantitative things, I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
You know, the front moving, it's so obvious. I mean, you know, it's at least, well, okay, it's obvious, but it's wrong in other contexts that there's a front, right? In this one, it's hard to see how you would get much else. So I think, the, you know, the basic phenomenon here is really simple. The main point I actually want to make about this is that the deterministic is a very good approximation. For short range, the deterministic approximation is very good, and for infinite range, the deterministic approximation is very good. Okay, so therefore, by interpolation, one would expect the deterministic approximation would be reasonably good, at least, in the intermediate regimes as well. Right, that's what you normally do. So I can understand here, I can understand there. Okay, in the middle, it's just a crossover. Okay, it's kind of more.
But it seems to me that as you go from one to the other,
right,
D will increase.
Right.
Which means that at some point, this width, even if you insist in calling it a width deterministically, may be bigger than your system size. If that happens,
yeah, okay,
then there's
a... Let me, since so we're theorists, we can take the system size infinity first and not worry about system size effect. Okay.
But you see, if you do it in the opposite way...
No, then I agree.
Because the Petri dish is a finite size. Then it's not correct that you can interpolate between the...
So there's all kinds of things that aren't correct about this, but it's also not very interesting. Right? I mean, so it's not, you know, certainly as far as spatial spread, linear is sort of what you'd expect, and then everything else is details. Right? Okay. But if you want to understand, you know, how it goes right or wrong, then one has to do with more than that. And the first thing is to think about, is this really D? Right? So supposing I now put in a J, and I can, for example, do a J that falls exponentially, so this falls off over some characteristic length, something like that. And so I can ask how things behave in this case. So then my D, of course, is just going to go as this squared, and you can again analyze it, and what you find is that this is no longer correct. So the V is not given by that. Okay, so V is bigger than the square root of 2 times the V times the S, because you can calculate D from this. And the reason is because the longer jumps already start having a bigger effect. And that's sort of pretty obvious. If I'm going along here and I jump out further, it's exponentially growing once it gets there. Right? So once it gets established, it doesn't die from fluctuations, it'll grow exponentially. And the growing exponentially here means that there's an advantage, there's a strong asymmetry, forward jumps matter much more, you don't lose much from backwards jumps and so on. So it's not surprising, and this is already true with the deterministic case.
So is this the front, or are these the extra clusters which we could see in your picture at the beginning? I mean, there was...
It doesn't matter. I can either look at the most advanced point, or I can look at the width of the region where it's close to saturated. It doesn't make a lot of difference. So depending, I mean, I can define where it is up to by various measures, and there's some subtle differences, but not huge ones. And certainly that's true with exponential. Okay? It turns out even when it's a power law, there's a sense in which there's something like a front. There's a characteristic scale within which it's mostly filled in and beyond which it isn't. Okay? But that certainly isn't obvious. That's the case. But here, the longer jumps start mattering. In the deterministic case, it gets long to be longer range. As soon as you put on the noise, you see that the effective epsilon-like parameter becomes much larger, and so the fluctuations matter more.
Then you tell me to shut up if I'm bothering you, but if this parameter that you're cutting off your exponential was larger than your.
No, okay. This is getting details that let's talk about later. Okay? I don't want to spend a lot of time on this short range case because there's all kinds of things one can do on this. It's a whole, there's books and books on it. So maybe you can ask this again. Okay. So let's look at the immediate cases. So the particular one which we turned out to have all the interesting behavior, I say, where this goes with one of R and B plus mu, and if mu is positive, then things are well behaved, and if mu is bigger than 2, then the diffusion coefficient is finite. Okay, so it's integrable. And so I would expect that I might get some change in behavior at mu equals 2. So what happens there? Well, there you can again do the deterministic approximation. Right, so one can again do the deterministic approximation. And if you do the deterministic approximation there, the same one-line argument that gives you the correct velocity over there gives you that what happens is you get very rapid growth. As soon as this is form of Powell law, the deterministic will tell you that I'm now going to define an L of t. So this is the characteristic size of the region which is occupied. Right, the region which it's spread, or if I want, I can say there's a characteristic number which goes as L to the D, and there's a number, so I can look at the total number which are there, and I can define L in terms of that if I want, and that gets away from the question which Thomas was asking about the outliers. Okay? So I can define L if I want as the number that are there to the one over D. So the deterministic result is that as soon as I get to this, that N grows as E to the S times T, but there's a coefficient in here, which is something like d over d plus mu, something like that. Okay. So all I do with exponential growth, I just renormalize exponential growth. So Powell law, even when it's diffusive, is enough to give you exponential growth. And I say there's a one-line argument, which I will leave for the reader to work out. You basically can get away with a linear approximation the same as you can to get this.
Mu is bigger than 2. This is true for all mu.
This is true for all mu. As mu goes to 0, you see this goes to 1, and all it does is just changes the exponential growth rate. So this is saying that in the deterministic approximation, okay, you would get this.
There's something, again, related to what I was asking before. It seems to me that there must be a regime in which you can have, instead of front propagation, coalescence of regions.
That's what this would be something which sort of looks like that, except this is wrong, okay? So this, I'm gonna right away cross this out and say what actually happens, okay? Okay, so I'm now gonna get to the interesting case. So this is wrong, and there's a very easy reason to see why there's something fishy about it.
So where did you write this down?
Why?
It's wrong, somebody write this somewhere.
As far as I know, it wasn't actually in literature, except for one line in our paper, which the referee insisted that a one-line argument wasn't enough, so we expanded it to a paragraph. Okay.
But you put it at the top of the paragraph wrong.
No, because you want to, this is straw man, right? This is under the assumption deterministic is good for short range, good for infinite range, the obvious guess is good in between. And there were lots of papers, including one well-cited ones and so on, as a measure which should be inversely proportional to whether one takes it seriously. Because it's correlated with the journal they're in, and that, there's a second order effect there. There's a thing that actually claimed that this was the right answer. I mean, so the literature on this is surprisingly bad, because basically getting it right is not hard. Okay, so that's what I'm going to now say how to get it right. But the first thing you want to do is show why is this wrong. Okay, so this is wrong, or at least if I erase the deterministic word first, would be wrong. So let's just consider a really simple thing. Let's ask, is it possible that it could go as fast as this? Okay, so let me ask for mu relatively large, and I'll say what it's large compared to in a minute. Okay? And I just want to look at the very simple question. Okay? So I'm not going to start drawing space-time diagrams. So this is going to be distance here, okay, and this is going to be time. Now I'm going to draw everything as if it's one-dimensional, but it doesn't really matter much, and there's the left side here as well. You basically, most of the arguments carry through any dimension. Okay? So I want to look at this. And let me just ask, supposing I have it growing with time, okay? So supposing that at some point I think that what I've got is by this time, I say I've got way out to here, and so I've got some characteristic scale at which I'm quite likely to have occupied. So this is sort of a typical point that I will have got to around time t. Okay, that's the one, someone there will become infected. Okay? And then I want to just ask, okay, now I've got a space-time picture, If I'm saying the long jumps are important, then there would better be at least one long jump. Right? So I just look at the total number of long jumps that come in here, and the total number of jumps, of long jumps. Okay, what do I mean by long jumps? Well, I mean, the natural guess is I want ones where I have some jump at some time that takes me out a long distance. Of course, a lot of ones that give me short distances doesn't do. So I want to ask if I have a jump of order L of t. Okay. Well, how many such jumps will I get? Well, let me say it's greater than or equal to L of t. And so the total number of jumps like that will be t. And then I, since I'm integrating over the volume, I will get my L coming into the to the mu. Okay. And then I will get that I have L to the D, because up to that time, of course, the most number of jumps I can have is from the regions that are already occupied. So the number of total number of long jumps has to be less than this. Okay. And then you immediately look at that and you say, wait a minute, if mu is large compared to D, it's substantially bigger than D. Okay, this can't possibly be right, that I won't have any long jumps. Okay, so for mu large, I get no long jumps, meaning I'm very unlikely to get a long jump. Okay, so I can't, this can't result can't be right that it's exponential for mu and less than d, as soon as I say it's a stochastic process. Okay. Now you can turn this argument into something which actually gives you bounds on what the right answer is. Okay, when might I expect to start changing from the behavior there? Right, so this is saying that the very long thing can't be right. Let's ask the other way around. When would I expect to get a finite speed? Okay. So if I say, when would I expect to get a finite speed? Then I can say, OK, let me take the argument I just did. And I would say my speed's likely to be finite as long as I don't have any long jumps within the assumed form of the growth. Right, so if I assume that L goes to BT, okay, then the total number of jumps, jumps with greater than L length up to time t. Then what will that say? Well, then I just look at this. This is now going as t, so this is much less than one, as long as mu is greater than d plus 1. Okay. So basically, if mu is bigger than d, I don't expect to have any long jumps playing an important important role, and I would expect with this result in here that I'll get this this being there. Now, it turns out there's actually a rather simple proof that that this is correct, and in fact, the proof actually takes you and gives you the behavior in the So this is one of the simulations I showed. They were d equals 2, and one of them was mu equals 3.5, where you're in the linear regime, but starting to get where the long jumps play a bit of role. The long jumps strongly change the speed. Okay, the deterministic approximation, which said they made the speed infinite, right? But they do strongly change it, and one can work out basically how they change the formulas. So this is saying that it really is linear growth for this, even though it's still at long range, And you notice this criteria has nothing to do with the criteria for diffusion, which was that mu has to be bigger than 2. Okay. Once this breaks down, okay, so as soon as mu is less than this, okay, then there's the possibility that you have long jumps. And so then you want to understand, sometime before you get out to here, okay, you are going to have a long jump, and you want to ask, what are the consequences of those long jumps? Okay, so then you get long jumps. Jumps, so you want to understand the rule. So we can do that. So let me look at my overall time. And supposing I'm interested at a time big T, and I want to know what the chances are if I get to there. Okay. So I'm now at time big T, and I'm getting out to some point there. I want to ask, what is this going to look like? So let's just get a sort of picture of what it is. If I assume that it's going faster than linear, right? So if, as we would expect, then L grows much, much bigger than T. Okay? So what does that mean? It means if I draw a picture of sort of the region that's occupied, it's going to may start off linearly, but then it's going to start bending around like this. Okay, so this is the region where I've at least got a lot of stuff in there. Okay, and by a lot of stuff, if I'm defining L this way, then it basically tells me how many are there already infected, and any of those can reduce a long jump. Okay. And now what I want to do, I want to get the infection to here. Okay, but of course, I don't get the infection to there by jumping directly to there. You get the infection to jumping close enough to there that it's likely to get to get infected. So let's supposing that at time little t there, I get some jump from someone in here who jumps out some distance over there. Okay. Of course, it could jump to here or to here or here. If it jumps to here, it doesn't do much good. If it jumps to way out here, it also doesn't do much good. Okay. Why is that? Well, then I have to, now I'm starting a new infection here. Okay, so my new infection here, this has to grow, and this has to have a good chance of getting to the point I'm interested in. So in order to get this to infect that, I need a seed here. I need a seed here where this distance here, right, is less than or of order L of t minus little t, because that's my remaining time. Okay, so in the remaining time, I need to go from a seed there to do this. Okay, so now we can make a very simple ansatz. These are all convex this way around. So you can say, okay, when do I need to jump? I need to jump if I'm getting to here, I have to be very close. If I'm jumping in a much earlier time, I have to be further away. And so there's actually an inverse picture I can draw here, which I can call a funnel. And this funnel actually is exactly the same shape as this, right? Because if I go to here, I can get to there. If I go to here, I can get to there. This funnel has the same shape. And the rule is that if I jump into the guess, if I jump into that funnel somewhere, time jump. Then I will be likely to see to cause an infection there. And one jump is enough. Right? So this tells me that long jumps can play a role, and this will give me a sort of one jump approximation to what's going on. Okay. So once you've made this observation, so you're sort of getting the whole behavior out is pretty simple, and then it's convincing oneself that it's right is a lot of work. Okay. So let's make this this assumption. So what do I have? I want to get that long jump. So I've got a source which at time t has a total number in it, which is L to the d at that time. So that's the total number that could produce this jump. Okay. Then I've got the size of the funnel. So the funnel has volume of L to the t minus t to the d. Okay. And then my probability of my jumps is just 1 over, let's look at a distance r, so I can call this a distance r, and distance r out, so that's 1 over r to the d plus mu, so this is my distance to my target that I'm looking at. Okay. And then what do I have? Well, then of course, I've got an integral over time, 0 to t of l to the d of t l to the d of t minus t. Okay. And you quickly see that since both of these are growing superlinearly, this is dominated by what happens near t over big T over 2. Okay, so this is maximum at t of order t over 2. Okay, and it's actually plus or minus order 1 from this. It depends on the details of what the shape is. But at least the simple guess would be it's a range around this, which is of order t. So what does that say? I want this thing to be of order 1 in order to get a jump, to get a seed. Okay? If this is of order 1, I'll get a seed, and I'll infect r at time t. I'm likely to. Okay? You can immediately use this to ask what is the chance that I get someone unlucky way out here. Because again, I've got this source, I've got a jump, there's a funnel locally. It's not likely to get there, but if it does get there, it'll start a new little epidemic here. So this you can also immediately use to tell you what the long distance plots are. So this is then something which I can now write a very, very simple recursion relation. I can write a very simple recursion relation. If it does infect this, so then I would say if this is of order 1, then r of t, then this l will just be of that order at time t, and so I will have the l of t is of order this. This r, and so I have a very simple recursion relation that L to the 2d of t over 2, okay, from that times t is of order L of t to the d plus 2. So this is a some simple iterative equation or a renormalization group of acts of twos in time, if you like that. And this is a crude approximation. It's sort of a mean field approximation. I'm ignoring everything in details, particularly I'm ignoring the multiple jumps here. Right? So this is very crude, because I, of course, do have C's out here, and I have regions occupied there, and this can jump to here, and I have things like that that I can then jump there. So I'm ignoring a lot of stuff, but this is the very crude, the crude argument. So you immediately see that d mu equals d plus 1 plays a particular role. Mu equals d plus 1 is when this has a condition that L goes linearly in T. Okay. So that gets that right. If mu is bigger than d plus 1, but not 2, smaller than d plus 1, but not too small. Okay. So if I now have mu in the range of d plus 1 down to d. Okay. So in this range here, you can very easily see that this is a solution that L goes as t to the beta, where beta is just equal to 1 over d u minus t. Okay, so if you go between d plus 1 and d, you have a power law. You can basically get this from dimensional arguments, provided you figure out which things you better keep and treat, and which things you better throw away. And so this is actually a rather simple, simple result. This is basically just the argument that you have one jump at that scale, okay, and that's enough to seed the rest. Okay, and the t over 2 is then just say the optimizing to make the argument right. But in this parallel regime, the fact that it's t over 2 doesn't matter much. I could have said t over 4 or something else. It doesn't make much difference. This is not very sharply beat, and this is the right answer. So this is the intermediate regime. What happens if it gets a longer range? Well, if it gets longer range, then it can go really fast. And so you can just work out that recursion relation. I'll just write out the answer. So for mu less than d, okay, then the answer is that the L of t goes as e to the coefficient times t to the eta. Okay. Eta equals 1 is the mean field case, the infinite range case, so you'd expect this will go to 1 as mu goes to 0. And eta turns out to be, let's see, what is it? It's log 2d over t plus mu. The log 2 coming in because you've got this factor of 2 renormalization, and this you can just plug in. This is the solution to that, that recursion relation. Okay. So we have this behavior here, which corresponds to a stressed exponential, okay, and that's what happens in this the longest regime. Okay, and you notice then that eta goes to 1, this goes to 1, and mu goes to this mu goes to 0. You become stressed exponential with amazingly short range, right? If d was equal to 3, okay? So if d equals 3, then this already applies for mu equals 2.5, okay? Which implies the diffusion coefficient is finite. Nevertheless, the long range part is completely dominant. Right? So as soon as you get transport plus exponential growth, right, then long things matter a lot more. Arguments about diffusion and power counting and things don't work at all. Okay. Maybe there's a way to get this from some field theory analysis. If so, somebody's welcome to try it. And if I was Shankar, I would have an elegant way of saying that. Like, if you want to go to order to perturbation theory, it's fine with me, but I'm not going to come with you. Okay. But I'm not. That's a quote. That's with proper attribution. I think he forgot that he said that once in a seminar.
But if you heard it, I probably said it.
He thinks I'm reliable. This is I'm flattered. Daniel.
Yeah. And so this assumption of single jump dominance for the Bolzano regime.
It holds in both regimes up to coefficients. Okay, up to coefficients and some changes of prefactors, which are there anyway, of powers of t in front of that. Okay. So that's actually rather a lot of work, and we spent a lot of time. Trying to prove and get good bounds on results. And the thing is, it's a very correlated process in the sense that if you have one jump, then another jump nearby doesn't help much. Okay, but jumps from that to longer ones really do help, and you start doing the obvious way of being more careful about this argument. And you look at intermediate length jumps, right? So you do this, and you ask, okay, now I've got from one point to another point, I'm at this point here where I have the jump from. So I've got a particular point where I have the jump, and then I'm going to eventually get up to here. And so you have to start thinking, well, what if these points start becoming together, and you get half the jumps, and you get divergences there, and so on. So to do the analysis, it's rather hard. To prove that this is a, in the parallel regime, that this is a upper bound is a few lines once you realize what the lines are. Okay, involving Levy flights. it takes, you know, the time to get to the few lines is hard, but who is it, the famous story about thinking for hard? He said something obvious, and someone asked why, and he thought for a very long time. He said, yes, it's obvious. So it's obvious after the fact. To show that it's that this answer is right is a little bit harder. This one is actually somewhat tricky, and it depends what you want to show. You can be careful. You can say, at what point are you mostly filled in? So at some point, everyone in the region has been infected. Or you can ask for a typical one, what's the chances of that? And you can try, and you have to go through various ways. And it's one of these things where to prove things, you have to handle a few of these things at the same time. So it's a pain. Chatterjee and May did prove various rigorous things about this, but they actually, their bounds are not as good as ours. In fact, some of the answers they didn't even get to asymptotics, but they have upper and lower bounds. So it's, yeah.
Then, if I understand, what these formulas are describing is just the growth of the overall population.
Right.
You're done with the spatial structure.
Okay, so let me now write down the spatial structure since you asked.
Yeah. So can I ask the question, actually?
Yeah.
If you actually look at the space where this is happening, should I imagine a front growing or the cluster of the guy who made the big jump at the original one emerging?
It's both. Okay, so it's multiple mergings on all scales what matters.
Right, so that's what I was trying to get to before. That there's two things that can happen. Front growth.
Right.
Emergence.
So let me say what this looks like. Okay, this is roughly speaking some. This is the density, and so it's roughly speaking some function of x over L of t. Okay, and let me say what this function looks like. Mm-hmm. So this is the probability that I've occupied at x at time t. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does this look like? This looks like that it's roughly speaking. So now I'm looking at as a function of x. So of course it saturates at small distances. It comes down. Only starts decreasing slightly. There's a scale of order here of order the. Of order L, and then it comes down and has a rapid tail, and this tail here looks like 1 over R to the D plus Q. It's basically the same scale as you get in the original hops.
Yeah.
Now, the amplitude of this is very different. This does not come from a single hop. This comes from a single seed. So in the far tail here, it is coming from single seeds. There's a reasonably sharp drop-off. If you look at correlations within this, they're fractal and so on. And so there's, you know, stuff going on in there. But basically, the approximation that it's reasonably filled up at some point and is full of rapidly after that. Right? And this, as you see, this is easily integrable because mu is positive. Right? So the total number out here is...
Can I just understand, if I take the two limits in which it's extremely local and in which it's infinite range, how does that L shift? Can you get it in one regime in which you only see the exponential and in another regime in which you only see the arm, especially if you have the finite size? And then you would have an extra axis inside that F.
Yes, 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 and yes, all those. You can get all the crossovers you would imagine with this. Right? So, but there's a very interesting one, and this is a very important one. Okay? So the very important one is I didn't tell you what happens with the marginal case. Okay? And then it turns out, if you try to do simulations at the size of 10 to the 8th in one dimension, basically the D drops out. If I scale, instead of R, I take R to the D everywhere, then it more or less drops out, except in this regime, but even there ends up essentially dropping out.
Excuse me, I thought that your argument is related to the Levy flight. So in the Levy flight, the mu equal 2 is always critical.
Right.
But you.
I said the argument is the argument uses Levy flights.
Yeah. But
the answer is not like a Levy flight.
Yeah. What is the reason why the difference between the Levy flight and even more than critical?
Yeah, okay. So the one dimension is the case where it's actually, I should say, our rigorous results are restricted to one dimension. Some of them are obviously extendable, some of them are more subtleties. Chatterjee and Day's ones that they have are they will in all dimensions. So you basically, you make a really simple answer. You say, let me assume it's completely filled up to some point. And it can be filled up to minus infinity. And then I look at the advance of the front. So I look at the advance of the furthest away individual from the origin in one dimension. The advance of that you can very easily see is a leafy flight, or it's bounded by a leafy flight. If you assume that when, as soon as you jump, you immediately film everything behind you, okay? And then that gives you the bound. It doesn't give you this. It gives you the wrong answer for this, for the shape, but it does give you the way the front, the front goes. Okay? And it's a very simple upper bound, and it turns out it's useful in getting coefficients and things right, because it gets the coefficients disastrously wrong. But you can use it and sort of bootstrap from it to get some other things. So this regime is very stochastic. Okay? In this regime, at every scale, not surprisingly, things sort of look similar to other scales. It's a Powell, that's not surprising. Okay? This regime here, most of the stochasticity is the short time. Okay? So if I measure my length scale at a given time, by counting the total numbers they infected, okay? And I scale things back to that, they're not very stochastic. I mean, there's a lot of variability, but it's not that stochastic. But how that L, what the L is at that time, has some uncertainty in it, variations in it, mainly coming from short time. Okay? So this one, for moral purposes, this is really a lot like exponential growth. Okay, it grows more slowly, but it's very fast. This is, if I think of the time, if I flip this around, the time to get to a given point, right, is a polylogarithm, right? So I flip this around. This is the time to get to a given distance grows as the log of the distance to the 1 over theta, right? So the time is still very, very still very fast. And the dynamics are different, but a lot of things, if you don't care about the times and you care about other properties, it is probably rather like exponential growth. So particularly if you start looking at coalescence issues and infection trees and so on, we don't understand it enough, but I think in a lot of ways this looks more like exponential growth than it does like anything else. Okay? And you don't need, as I said, you do not need very long long range to get this coming in at all. Okay? So these are very easily integrable tails. They're the kind of tail that one has almost no information on at all. I'm going to make a connection with avalanches and fractions. Okay? So the simplest way to get rough fractal surfaces, rough fracture surfaces, like Elizabeth Bouchot's beautiful experiments, the simplest way to get those is to say the residual stress correlations in the material. Okay? But those residual stress correlations don't have to fall off very rapidly. They have to fall slightly slower than 1 over r to the d. And those are really, really difficult things to observe. Okay? That will give you these very rough fractal surfaces. So it's something where, you know, rather weakly long-range correlations will do that. Just the anisotropy by itself gives you 1 over r to the d. So you only need slightly longer range than you get from local things in order to get those very rough fracture surfaces. Right? So it's something also where you get a bootstrap, a sort of amplification of the effects of a Powell law tail, much more than one would sort of naively expect.
Naive experimental. There are a lot of data on the epidemic spread.
Right.
Can you call it some type of epidemic or some type of
or not? So there is. So one of the things which is an epidemic, it's an epidemic of mammon, and is looking at spread of dollar bills in the U.S. So they do tracking of looking at numbers of dollar bills, and then you look at what numbers of bills are brought into banks as well as another place. So this is not an epidemic, and then you look at how that depends upon distance, how long it takes dollar bills to get from one place to another. And within the US, out to a border of, I don't know, 400 or 500 kilometers, that's roughly a Powell law, which would put the dynamics into this regime. For the actual epidemics, then one has to worry about network structure, and that I'll come to in a minute. And at this point, it's not clear that there is data which can be directly compared in any way. It's more giving you, sort of a framework for thinking about the long-range effects. But the people will only normally say about networks is very misleading, and so that'll. I just want to say that what happens in the marginal case, and so the reason for this is that if you want to do simulations and not get fooled by them, you had better understand the marginal cases. And so the marginal case when mu equals d, okay, so then L goes as e to the whatever it is, 1 over 4 d log 2 log squared t. And now I'm going to be precise. It goes as log t plus a log t squared, and where a is between less than or equal to 3 halves and greater than halves. which is then rigorous labels. Okay, log logs. I've written a paper where the small parameter was 4 pi over log log, which is really a hard parameter to get to be small, but anyways. The paper has a lot of citations anyway, which goes back to how telling you how bad a measure that is. So there's this rigorous thing, and then it depends on what definition you use. I think some other definitions, 3, depending on what definition you develop. But so why do I bother telling you this? Okay, well, firstly, you can check this. But secondly, this behavior is associated with extremely slow crossovers. So even in one dimension with sizes of 10 to the 8th, if mu is anywhere near 1, okay, from half to 1.5, you're dominated over very wide ranges by this. And so to understand any simulation data at all, even when you carefully go to every parameter of order 1 and you run these other crossovers, the crossover is completely dominated by this, and over a wide range of mu, in fact, it looks like this. And so you have to go to really long scales to get to this, unless mu minus d is large. Okay. And the crossover length scale grows exponentially in the small parameter, so there's a crossover, some crossover length scale, which grows as e to the 1 over mu minus d squared. Okay, so it's really, you really have to get to long scales. So it's telling you an asymptotic is actually not very useful. So, but this heuristic argument you can use for any function. This heuristic argument works well for all kinds of J of R. It's just you don't go through the next step, you don't get asymptotics. You just use this directly. Sorry, I missed the setup here.
I'm sure you can use this argument to get this crossover scale.
Yeah, you can basically get a lot of things out from this argument. You can calculate the crossover scaling functions, and you can show your data, numerical data fit those very well. So you can understand everything in that situation.
So you're saying I should think of this in a normalization group sense as a critical point separating two regimes with a marginal.
Right, and with a very slow crossover, so it dominates, the marginal dominates over very wide.
Very nice.
Exactly. Very nice. So it's one where if you actually want to get things right numerically, for large regimes, so essentially, very crudely, there's linear growth, there's this marginal growth, and it's exponential growth. And then until you get to very long scales, when you'll see the power laws and other things. So now I want to just come to the sort of thinking about more realistic things, in particular if I'm thinking about going around on a transportation network. Okay. So if I want to go around, instead of just randomly picking one point from one place and taking it to somewhere else, I say for getting things fast, the epidemic's clearly spread by air traffic. And flu is the one that's the best data on, as far as one that actually spread widely, of looking at the role of the air networks there. And I think it's that all of the flu or the new variants all start in areas of China and Southeast Asia and spread from there. So you can even, you sort of know where the source is on some time scale. And then you get spreading from there. Okay. So there is, of course, exponentially larger number of papers on doing anything like this on networks than doing it in a continuum. Maybe it's only stretched exponential, but it's big. Okay. And so we can ask if I have a situation where I have a network. So let me first consider the situation, which is reasonable in some countries maybe, where I have a reasonably uniform population, right? And I have a transportation network that has some logic to it, right? So my transportation network has some nodes in it, and those nodes sort of have the long distance links between them, and then they're hubs, and there are smaller nodes here with local things going out to there, and smaller nodes around here, and at some point I start replacing with trains and taxis and so on. So I sort of get some sort of hierarchically designed network. Okay? And then you ask, what is the dynamics on this network? And this is where all the network things, it's amazing you can still do it. Network papers very rarely have numbers associated with the networks. Okay? And without the numbers, you can't say anything very intelligent about them. Okay. With the numbers, you can say more intelligent things, but you can't publish them. So it's, there's a trade-off there. So what number do I want to associate with this? Let me ask a really simple question. Supposing I look at people at a hub airport, and I just ask them where they're going. Okay. Most of them are not taking the really long jumps. Okay. So if I'm going to try to model this, I would say there's some probability, which is of actually getting on a flight. So there's some probability of H of R, which is something like a probability at hub, you know a distance R. So there's some function like that, okay, which is certainly a decaying function, right? And then I ask, okay, given this, it's telling me that these hubs are clearly playing a role, okay, but they're not playing as an important role as one might think. So now I want to think, you have to think about what kind of epidemic are you talking about. Jim doesn't think this is true.
All of the people at hubs, yeah. I don't know, you're making one long jump and then it's working.
Right, so there's a lot of the ones that are, but it still is true that it depends on the hub, it depends if it's train stations, varying things, okay? So I'm just saying, there's certainly some function here, which of course depends on the type of hub and so on. I'm being simple, but I want to ask the general thing.
I assume you're not thinking about propagation from one point in this network to neighboring points, because the people are passing through the hubs rather rapidly and going to some destination. Okay.
So this comes exactly to the question about what is the nature of the epidemic. So if I take an epidemic like HIV, okay, most people do not transmit HIV when they're on an airplane. Even though somebody who travels a lot on airplanes is responsible for a substantial fraction of all the early cases in the US. But as far as I know, they were not mostly on the airplane, and probably not even mostly in the airports, okay, those transmissions. So if you have something where you're not infectious while you're traveling around, then the only purpose of the network is to get you from one point to another, right? And then it doesn't matter what the properties of the network are at all. The only relevant thing is how people travel. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, people who live nearer the hubs tend to travel more often and so on. So there's, of course, all kinds of heterogeneities in it, okay? And so this is not a very good approximation, but if you stay in a city and look at travel within a city, and that's actually the kind of cases where like dengue fever spreading within a city is one that is actually data on, and they try to use that to try to manipulate and prevent the disease spread. So if you look at networks in a city, it's probably a better approximation that the network serves you to get you from one place to another, but the probability you go to a given distance in a day is to something that distance away. It doesn't depend that much on where you are. And so the network is irrelevant except for providing providing the means for transport. Okay. Provided there are actually enough links to give you the long hops. Right? If there are not links which are very long, then of course this breaks down. So if if I look at the probability of having a connection, so I can say K of R is the probability of a connection of 2 points separated by R. Okay. So this is like, the product of these is basically like my J before. I've got the probability of a connection and the probability I actually take it. Okay, so roughly speaking, if I define these in the right way, it's like this. If the probability of a connection falls off rapidly enough, then I need to take a large number of steps. Okay. So this goes back to an earlier problem, which I worked on with Rava da Silveira, and we ended up never quite finishing it, or at least never submitting it anywhere. And where it was just looking at these things actually on these kinds of networks. Okay. This is a question, if I look at the properties of having the connectivity, what does that tell me about how many steps I have to take? Right. So this is if you're a traveler planning your trip, and I'm just looking at the network, and I can ask in S of R, is the minimum number of steps, number of flights, to get to a distance R. Okay. Well, clearly, if there's no long flights, this goes linearly in R. Long distances until very recently it went linearly in R. Okay, but I can ask more generally, what does this do? Okay, and this is one that things have worked out. I think Biscup is the actual paper that published the results. But there again, these are less than one line, and there's a very, very similar one for it, which is similar to the one I gave. So this is, if you say that if I make this connectivity just to be the same as I make this go as 1 over r to the d plus mu, then the result is that the mu bigger than d, but less than 2d, if mu is bigger than d, mu is bigger than d, then you basically get no connections, there are no links, okay? And then the s goes linearly with the with r. You have to take the long term stuff under. But if mu has to be bigger than zero, so if it's less than d, then you get the number of links goes as log r to the 1 over eta, with the same eta which I now erase. Okay, so you get polylogarithmic behavior. Okay. So this is a well-connected network, and I guess people now will define for the power laws the definition of a small world network is one where this is true, so you have polylog behavior. Okay, and obviously the best you can do is where this is just linear in the number. If you actually want to make your network so that you can really transmit things on it and you don't, then there are stricter conditions. So basically, the sort of extreme limit is when you're like this, and there's intermediate ones where if you're very likely to hop, where the dynamics changes, and the sort of you can lose some of the power law range. But basically, on such a network, even as long as you've got disease, which is not infectious when you're traveling, then you get the dynamics of the change. The opposite limit. So the opposite limit, and maybe SARS is in this limit, I don't know. The SARS limit. Where it's you're infectious before you have symptoms, as you're traveling, you're in a confined space, and you transmit it to other people on the airplane, or at least in the airport, something we're in the smoking lounge. And in that case, of course, the network is absolutely crucial, right? Because then you get to a node and you can choose damage. So then the dynamics can be very, very fast, and the network plays a crucial role. Okay. And there's obviously, of course, intermediate cases. The dynamics changes somewhat if you have recovery. Okay, so if you have recovery, and the recovery time is relatively short. Okay, so once you're infected, you then recover, you can no longer transmit to anyone else, right? Or at least can stop being infectious. And then, of course, this sort of integral of the time, everyone who's been infected can infect anyone else, goes away. You lose the integral on time, and you essentially get back to results which are more like this. So in that case, if I replace this, the number of steps, by the time, then at least at long distances, this goes like the number of steps. And so you go to a regime where the network can play more of a role, but just more generally, it's taking the you don't have this sort of cumulative effect of everyone being affected before some time. So in practice, things depend upon that. So I do want to just in the last few minutes say something which I think is actually much more interesting overall, which is about the brain and transmission of information in the brain. And so this is actually work that started with Rafa Del Silveira and also Larry Abbott, but never really pushed through, partly because it wasn't clear what data would help one do it, but is now becoming more and more relevant. Okay, so here's the question. There's a classic task to look at fast high-level processing. And the classic task is you show two pictures, okay, you flash them, one picture has an animal in it, one doesn't. And you're supposed to say which one has the animal in it. Now if you have to say or you have to move your hand, it's rather slow. If you just flick your eyes to the one that has it, that's the fastest, the time delays are short. Okay? So a bit of input information is that to get up into the cortex at all takes around 40 or 50 milliseconds after the photons arrive. So there's a 40 or 50 millisecond delay. Okay. So how long does it take before your eye is observed to stop the saccade to the monkey? Anyone guess?
30 milliseconds.
Any other guesses?
60.
How long is the total reaction time? Like you see, it's a high-level processing task. Yeah. You see two pictures, one is an animal, you have to saccade your picture towards the one with the animal. And how long before the saccade starts? Well, you can measure the saccade starting from when you get the flash of the image.
The brain.
Okay. Boris probably knows. Okay. So 130 milliseconds, and it actually the variability is not all that high. It varies somewhat from person and context and so on, but it's not huge. If you do it with finger response or something else, there's much more variability. So that means that to get from when it first arrived in the cortex, okay, to when you respond to it, including the muscle output, right, it's 80 milliseconds. There are even faster things. If you're reaching for something, and the thing moves while you're reaching for it, and you start looking at muscle output to the various bits of the arm, the muscle output to the muscles up here, the coarse grain ones, is even faster. Okay, that's on the order of 70 milliseconds, something like that. So it's only about 30 milliseconds after things arrive in the cortex. Now, Jim was not completely off, because there are processes that short-circuit the cortex. and which involve vision, but not involving, and things like the motion in response to vision, they can short-circuit the cortex, especially if you're highly trained. But things that involve high-level processing, like figuring out what an image is, you know, what image is there, those ones, as far as we know, all go through the cortex. Not only do they all go through the cortex, they go through multiple layers of the cortex. And people will typically say that it's about 6 levels up in the cortex that you need to go through sequentially in order to make this, to do this task. Which means that in the 80 milliseconds from when it arrives in the cortex to when you're giving a motor output, you have to get through 6 layers of the cortex. Okay, so you've got around 15 milliseconds per layer. Okay? If you look at recordings in the brain, people will record, for example, in the lots of colleagues of Albert's, will record in the first level of visual cortex, second level of visual cortex, and so on. They will typically record, and they will say, this neuron is responding to this, and they will take data over a couple hundred milliseconds, and the peak responses are at order 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds. Okay. By that time, the information has been passed on and goes through several other layers. Okay. So there is some intrinsic mismatch between the timescales people actually can measure with the electrophysiological recording by measuring a small number of neurons and how fast we actually do things. Okay, so there's a major problem in understanding neural processing, which I claim is a very important one to work on, because the closer something is to seeming like some fundamental limits, the more rapidly you can throw out most possible explanations. So all the feedback processes and all kinds of other things that go on play a huge role in our brain. This is so fast that it's hard to believe that many of those plays a pivotal role. You can, with magnetic measurements, which are very coarse spatially, but you have very high time resolution, you can sort of see some of this process going, but in a very, very loose sense of some kind of activity. So this brings to a very simple question. How many wires do you need in the cortex that run across the brain? Right? These regions are quite far apart. They have to go 10 centimeter scale. How many wires do you need across the brain in order to have the brain be able to transmit information around fast enough, even in principle? And so I better have a very small number of steps involved in getting anything from any part of the brain to the other. So there's a very then interesting wiring question, which is if I want to lay out wires in the brain, and let's assume that the wires are random, it's certainly not true for the primary visual cortex. By the time you get past that, it already starts looking pretty random. And I want to ask, how many wires do I need around the brain of what lengths in order to get to have be able to do high-level things fast? Okay, and then you say, well, fast means sort of limit of what you can, of the kind of things you can do. And it's clear that lots of regions of the brain light up in these kind of tasks. Okay, but those lighting up, again, there's time scale issues and so on. And so one has to be a little careful what one is asking about. Unfortunately, even the fast probes are, so the sensitivity of the electrophysiology is very short. If the neuron you look at happens to have a spike, you can see it. But most of the time, it doesn't. Right? It's resetting, it's doing something else, or it's feeling lazy, some other neuron doing the work. Right? So in order to do this, you need a lot of more neurons involved than the ones you can actually track. Okay. But you can just ask the in-principle question just in terms of the wiring. Okay. And this is wiring which gets from one region of the cortex to the other. So it's wiring that goes outside of the gray matter, which is the cortex, and through the white matter, which is, the white matter is almost entirely wiring, literally. So it's a problem. The brain has a lot in common with sophisticated integrated circuits and so on, is that all the problem is fitting in the wiring. The basic processing, there's no issues with So if you want to do, you know, a physicist's model of the brain, if you've got a thin spherical shell, which is the cortex, and you've got the neurons that come out of it and go various distances. Okay. And you want to, you know, do this wiring of these neurons in a way that will enable you to, say, get information around the polylogarithmic time, polylogarithmic number of steps. It translates into time. Well, it doesn't translate into time because you actually, if you want your long connections to be fast, they need to be thicker. Speed scales with the diameter. So you actually, the long ones actually cost you more space. Right? And you are definitely space limited. As you go up to bigger brains, the amount of the white matter. So this is the white matter, this is the gray. The amount of the white matter grows more than linearly with the amount of the gray matter. Okay? And so it's clear that the sort of limitations on there associated with the amount of white matter, you know, this is all convoluted and so on, actually helps on this because it's shorter distances involved. And of course, there is some logic to have what these spreads look like. So there's just a very simple question, you know, how much wiring do you need? So I can think of this as being like a two-dimensional problem, and I've got things, the distance is a two-dimensional distance, But then I've got a constraint of the number of wires that better fit into the volume that I'm looking.
So the thickness is also variable?
The thickness is variable, and in fact, for certain processes, the thickness is very finely tuned. Okay, for the visual system, it doesn't seem to be, but that's as far as I can tell, that's because nobody's looked. I mean, it might not be, but it is true that nobody thinks we've really looked at that. Okay? And that's actually a very important question associated with spike time. So this is just a simple question, is what are the distribution of lengths of wires? In spite of the hundreds of millions of dollars certainly being spent on connectomics in the brain, this much simpler question of what people are looking at, because this involves big, thick cables. These are from a few tenths of a micron up to a few microns. They're quite easy to find. They're quite easy to track. This is not being done, as far as I know. Okay, of actually looking at the wire. There's a very important question on that, which is how much do I need information that I need to transmit? Right, so the simplest question is, here's a region in which the bit input from the eye is coming in. Here's a region in which the sort of high-level decision is getting made. This has to bounce around to some other regions in between, something like that. Is I can just ask the shortest possible, how many synapses do I need to get to here? But that obviously isn't enough. I've got to have a lot of parallel paths in order to influence it. So I have to start asking things about, okay, I've got some region here. I want to sort of influence it. How much input do I need to influence that region? Right? And that's also a question, that sort of scaling has not really been addressed much in even among the physicists looking in the theoretical neuroscience. So the scaling issue from there of how many different connections, I need parallel connections, I need parallel ones. In particular, I need quite a few of the long ones in order there. So you have to, you know, you start making some, you know, natural guesses about that and so on. And you conclude that this is really difficult. That the wiring issue in the brain, you start putting in numbers, it's really difficult to see how you get these things really fast. Okay, and really get enough steps in there. It depends, of course, on how many steps you think are involved. And maybe there are fewer steps than one would naively think from what is known about the connection between the neurons. Okay? And you want to be in one of these parallel regimes, but you need the conditions on the parallels are different because of this sort of influence question of how much do you need to be transmitting to get to influence another region. So this is one where there's quantitative measurements that should be being done. There is, you know, sort of predictions in the sense of once you start saying what the wiring looks like and you start making assumptions that people know how to test, sort of, about the inputs coming into a region and what they stimulate activity within that region, and you can start measuring that. And you can try to put things together and try to sort of make sense of this and ask, you know, is there any feedback possibilities involved and so on. But it definitely, one is doing things at the close to the limit at which is reasonable, or even beyond what's reasonable, just as far as the amount of volume available for the wire. The issue about the widths, I think that it's essential for this to be done as fast as it is, for the actual timing of individual spikes to be important. Right? So if you look at the signal that goes down a neuron, it's not much for a while, then it may have a spike, and then have a string of spikes like this. Okay? And there's a string of spikes, and that's mainly the information of other neurons. A simplifying feature of this is that the only long-distance information is associated with spiking things. Locally, there's other ways of transmitting information too. But the long-distance part only goes through these axons. They're all excitatory and so on, and they have this kind of behavior. What is normally done, and by normally I include, say, the theoretical physicists work on this mostly, is you say, okay, the neuron doesn't really care about the precise timing of the spikes. What it does is it integrates over some window, so it may integrate over some window of order 15 milliseconds, something like that. And it just, total amount of spikes coming in that window from one input neuron, right, so this is coming in, and I've got one other one coming in from other neurons and so on. So it basically integrates all the inputs over some time with some weight function. And people usually put times of this number or longer. Okay. If you do that, and we're saying you have to do processing within a region, on a time scale of 15 milliseconds, you're clearly not sensitive to things associated with spike timing. It's a very crude, you may as well treat it as a continuum and treat it as an analog processor, okay? Which is what almost all the work does. Okay? They may say that spikes are important, but it's still a personal process for producing the spikes, which again, you run into the same issues with time, with the time scales. Okay? So to get this working, my instinct is that the actual timing of the spikes has to be important. Now, what evidence do we have on that?
The people like Bill Bianic believes that.
Believes this?
Yes, not this, no, but the position and the time.
Bill may believe it, but you would not necessarily gather that from the papers.
but when you look at the eye and H1, yeah. You see it.
No, so what is known, so the retina will transmit spikes up to the brain whose timing at the output of the retina is reproducible to around a millisecond. Okay? The evidence that even the first level in the visual cortex, V1, uses that information is very weak. Yeah, it's consistent with it just doing something more like this with maybe a 5-10 millisecond window. Okay? And a lot of the analysis that Michael Berry and Bill Bialik and done of the retina is actually they immediately bin things in this kind of time interval. Okay, so they do exactly this kind of binning. Now you could ask, why would the system transmit precise spikes if they're not used? We know they're used in hearing. Okay, maybe they're not used in vision. They're absolutely essential in aspects of hearing. And my instinct is that you cannot do the processing fast enough with high-level processes unless you really use the spike time. Okay, and probably first spike arrivals, people have done some toy models and they have troubles with sort of the resetting and so on. I haven't really been thought. So this thinking about this connection problem and there's just one behavioral observation about people, and you can do things in monkeys and so on as well, that suggests that one really does need to understand the processing and then the propagation things on a much shorter time scale than people will normally look at. If you want to get coherent information from one region to another, you might think you need to adjust the timing of the propagation speeds such that you don't lose 5 milliseconds in incoherence between different ones going across. Right? And we know there are feedback processes that do that. Well, do we know? We know there must be feedback processes that do that associated with hearing. I don't know if we, they presumably are there associated with vision and things as well, but they haven't been studied. And so it's a really nice set of problems for theoretical physics of coming from just observations about the geometry and this very fast behavioral thing to say that actually puts very severe constraints on some of the processing of aspects of processing not understood, even in regions where people will say they understand, like in the first level visual cortex. But it just doesn't add up. You can't do it there. The newer ways of trying to get optical recordings, of spike recordings involving calcium-sensitive dyes and optical recordings, okay? Those, unfortunately, the sort of naive measure of response time is tens of milliseconds. Okay? But what that really is, if you look at the response as a function of the time, so you put a stimulus on here, there's a very fast rise, and then there's a long tail. Okay? So this rise is on the time scale of a few milliseconds. And so if you can use the initial rise information, you can actually, and you know what you're looking for, this is a crucial one you need to know what you should be looking for, then you can actually get information, at least by the next generation of optogenetic tricks and so on, on some of these fast recordings. Larry Abbott and some collaborators, I forgot, involved in this, looking at C. elegans, the nematodes, have used the fact that you can use this early response to actually get information about and is associated with the head wiggling of the worms and how they use that for essentially measuring gradient. And so you can actually use this. And so if you start knowing what you should be looking at instead of just collecting huge amounts of data and analyzing it, which is the way the field has gone, then you say, okay, there may be tools to enable you to get at some of these fast processes at looking at individual neural level, which one clearly needs to understand the actual processing and the transmission and so on.
So there's been some work on simplified chains.
Right.
The notion that
you synchronize the firing.
An attempt to find sets of neurons which generate the coincident spike, spike coincident beyond the Poisson.
Right.
Of course, probability that random two things will do that is small.
So these ideas, so most often these have gone back a while and have been looked at recently of having some sort of somewhat synchronized firing which then can propagate and you would hope can also regain synchrony if it loses some in transmission. The evidence for that actually occurring is weak. That's probably, again, you don't know what to look for. Because you don't know which neurons to look at. Because it's the neurons that are receiving something from here which has been affecting something else. And you have no idea which to look at. If you could start doing these multiple cell looking at them, then say, geez, okay, this neuron, these thousand are the important ones, and then focus in on those and ignore the other 100,000 you measure. Then you can start using much more information because you start getting prior information that you can use. And so it's the kind of things that can push towards what one is doing. There are some models, and actually Marcus Meister and Hans Chomsky have done a little bit on this, and Simon Thorpe, who is the one responsible for these very fast behavioral measurements, and some of the magnetic recordings with those, and I think Poggio maybe also. They've looked at some models where you use the timing of the first spike that comes through. And you can certainly do things at the level of models that go very fast. But as far as I can see, none of them get at the question of what about all the other input and the fact you have to reset. And so you can do flashing images too. You can flash images very rapidly and ask how quickly can you get one image after the next. And again, you find you do it much faster than the sort of nominal response times that people tend to use. So there's somehow some resetting. Most of the neurons are not being involved in a given fast process like this. So there has to be understanding how those things can work when there's a whole mixture of neurons that could be involved. Then, as far as I know, that hasn't been done. But again, there's a real theoretical challenge there. One has enough idea of what the models are to really make, I think, progress on that. And then also stimulate people as to, okay, what information would actually like? Right? Other measurements you can make on the optic nerve. It's the optic nerve itself, which has, what is it, 10 to the 10 to the 6th, somewhat between 10 to the 6th and 7 neurons in it, which gets all of the information from the retina. You know, other information about that, associated with synchrony and asynchrony and so on, that one might be able to actually probe. But it really is a crucial one that one needs guidance as to what to look for. And especially with the next round of the technology. Yes.
So it's about your short-range model.
Yeah.
So about Fisher equation, it's known that the speed with the square root of 2 is achieved for compact initial data. What makes you think that the earthquakes, but the epidemics propagates with the compact initial data? Because
you start with one individual.
Your stasis is unstable around. So
right.
There may be some kind of preliminary development, and then it explodes.
So that, but the preliminary, these models will exactly do that. If you have short motion and long distance motion, then what you do is you get a small local spread, and then you get these big jumps and spreads. So that's exactly the kind of motion that people, the kind of way the epidemic seems to spread, right? And then you have cases like, you know, Ebola in the past, where there's just some local thing that never gets beyond that. Or HIV, I guess going back to the 1920s, whenever it's supposed to have come to humans, the first evidence for, where there's some local spread, but you never get the long distance bits. So that's a certainly an important process, but that's you know directly included in this framework. So. But then you know certainly I think if you really get linear spread and short enough range motion, that's a good approximation. There surely are some, but it would be interesting to and even there, it's not the diffusion kernel is what you need. You need something which is weighted towards the tails, even with exponential fall off. Right? So you really know what even the appropriate weighting is for understanding that. It's something which, again, as far as I can see, is not in the literature. And that's, you know, basically simple.
Yeah, I see in the newspapers there every so long people reports of people trying to model the spread of Ebola. Do that make any sense?
Wait, the physicists make it in the newspaper. I haven't looked at what they're doing. I mean, people have thought very serious about the spread of HIV, right? Both geographically and other ways. Dengue, my understanding, I've looked at it with the cities and so on. Ebola is too early stage, but doesn't have that much data. At the Superbugs workshop this summer, there was a spread of an epidemic within a hospital of an antibiotic resistant drug, where they had detailed sequencing from patients and from nurses and so on. And even with that, unless it happened later in the book, it was very difficult to actually figure out the infection change and so on from full sequence information and taken in real time and so on. So they're very difficult to infer these, but what the crucial one is you need to do a lot of information potentially there, but you need the underlying models to be able to pull things out from. Right? And that's one of the things which tends to be lacking in both epidemiology and in population genetics, is wanting to do statistical analyses without a series of underlying models where you say, okay, this is the important parameter, this is the important one, we can try to use these data in that in some way, and this would be the better data to have.
So now very much in the same vein, right? They're trying to do forensic genomics, right? Mm-hmm. So you can imagine, collecting 1,000 genomes in Liberia and 1,000 genomes Sierra Leone, and each genome will come with a time and place stamp, right? So you can reconstruct the tree from that.
Yeah.
So,
So after the fact,
one can now take your some classical models and ask, what if anything can be inferred from some presumably spatial temporal structure in that reconstructed tree?
I mean, so I guess one would want to do that maybe with flu rather than Ebola. I mean, there are much bigger numbers, there's more things overall. But no, that's right, exactly. So you can ask.
Well, maybe with flu or maybe with Ebola. I mean, the bottom line is, I don't think there. Right, so that data has been taken, but
maybe
it's not taken in such a way that you know, the time and place. I don't know, presumably they know enough to to store that. Right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think even sort of theoretical attempt to reconstruct
from
that data
with some simple model about
it's not obvious.
No, I agree.
Right? It's not obvious that it's possible, and maybe there are some observables that are more informative.
Yeah. And it may be so. HIV. It turns out that the spread of HIV epidemic within the in the West was determined by the extremely long tail of the distribution of rate of her having new sexual partners. And it was such so far out in the tail that you basically couldn't do anything because it was a small number of individuals were involved. Right? So there it's not just like even the small number of plane flights and so on, it really is a small number of individuals. So, you know, in Ebola, there may well be at this stage things like that. You know, one person takes it from one village to another one. By the time you get to the bigger epidemics like flu and so on, it is probably not true that a whole epidemic in the US was started by one person arriving from China. And so there's much more complicated things, and then you might hope that some of the rare fluctuations, the rare event effects, don't dominate quite as much. But one doesn't know. I mean, that would certainly be something about the dynamics of it and the flu, one knows the numbers well enough, then one could probably try to back out. And you say, does it have to have been true that this was a sort of initial wave that really was responsible? The bigger the basic infection parameter, the number of individuals that an individual is infected, in fact, the bigger that is, the more you're dominated by rare events, and the harder it is. The Ebola, that number is of order, it's of order two, but they don't know, I mean, how well defined it is even. It's pretty big. Mm. And the spatial metric is, you know, for these things is not necessarily the right one and so on. But it does, you know, you can deform and try to find a sort of appropriate metric. Which is, I mean, the spatial one isn't the right one, but you would like to go backwards and say, okay, a sort of metric is on this. And then the next time you get an outbreak, you're saying the absolutely crucial bit is cutting off these things. Right? And that is the one where one would hope it's useful. Like HIV was a truck route to Africa. It really spread the HIV issue. And then, of course, other things as well. And then you cut off the behavior on that. And, you know, things are very sensitive. So there's a famous case of actually gonorrhea among gay men. I think San Francisco was the one with the careful studies, probably others too. And they noticed that at one point it plummeted. And gonorrhea you can get lots of times. So it isn't you get immunity, you can get lots and lots of times. And so it's a good one for the purposes of studies and trying to understand the dynamic. And people said, oh look, everyone must be changing their behavior a lot and practicing safe sex, and that's why it's plummeted. And then they realized, and I forgot who it was for the numbers, that in fact what it went is from an average growth of 1.2 to 0.9, and then the epidemic dies out. Right? And then in fact rather small changes of behavior in more recent years with the HIV drugs and so on has made the gonorrhea epidemics come back again. And because you're playing around with numbers just above and just below one. Right? But that does mean that you're very sensitive to if you make the right interventions, they don't need to be very big ones, you just need to be able to from small numbers or with the transportation and so on to do things there. And say dengue, apparently there's some active projects trying to understand spread within cities. And they and trying to sort of make sense of that and what strategies you do as far as insecticides and so on or any quarantine that you might do and things. And they're somewhat more homogeneous and there's lots of examples. They flare up and they keep, so you can sort of you can try to collect enough information to maybe try to do. Can be useful, provided you have enough wiring in the brain. But this is the thinking, which is a different question.